Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Genuine Chit Chat. This week, I speak with my buddy Wayne again, except last week we spoke about, well, we delved into the human condition and sort of what makes us human, good versus evil, and his two books, A Light in the Mist and Scarecrow, two fiction books, which I highly recommend people go and check out. But this week, we're actually talking about paleontology, because Wayne, as well as being an accomplished author, he also has a degree in paleontology. Now, paleontology is basically just the study of fossils and animals and plants, but also, you know, the history of life on Earth up to essentially human recorded civilization. So we delve into that sort of thing, and it's kind of like the beginner's guide almost for paleontology. Now, some of the topics we discuss in this episode are mass extinction events, not just of the dinosaurs, but of all the creatures that have lived on Earth and sort of things that can trigger extinction events. We speak about, obviously, fossils and dinosaurs, evolution, sea bears, which are tardigrades, which are this crazy animal that can survive through relatively anything. We talk about it a little bit. You know, the Jurassic and Cretaceous period, giant insects, 3D mapping, climate change, just general nature. We talk about absolutely loads of different things in this podcast. It's actually one of my favorites that I've recorded so far. And if you really enjoy this episode, that's great. I'd recommend checking out my other science-y episodes. I've got a mini series with my buddy Josh called Science But Simple. The first one we talk about how light bulbs work, and the second one we talk about how the tides and gravity works. It's just basically explaining science in a really simple and easy to digest manner, which is great for me, really. So those episodes are also released on this podcast. It's all just under one umbrella, the Genuine Chit Chat podcast, where I'm always the host. So make sure you guys check that out if you're interested. And I'll give more details about that sort of stuff at the end. So I guess after a little cheeky promo, we're going to get right into it.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jim.
Hi, my name is Kit Karen.
And we host the Forgotten News podcast.
Jim, I know we're in the middle of recording the promo for our podcast, but a thought just occurred to me.
Okay.
People praise the future because it is blank and featureless. They're afraid of the past because it is full of real and living things.
Wow, Kit, that is absolutely true for most people, but not for us.
On our podcast, we tell true stories from before you were born. Stories that made headlines maybe for a day or a week, then disappeared just as suddenly. It might be a true crime story or an unsolved mystery. It might be a strange or spooky story. It might even be a funny story.
And if you want to hear some exciting stories about Franklin Roosevelt, Susan B. Anthony, or Alexander Hamilton, well, I'm sorry, you'll need to find a different podcast.
Yes, indeed. Because our show tells the stories of the footnote people from history. And sometimes, the people who didn't even make it into the footnotes.
If you are someone who would like to hear lost but true stories from long ago, then you should definitely listen to the Forgotten News podcast.
Yep. The Forgotten News podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, also known as iTunes, and nearly every podcatcher out there. So, don't be afraid, cat. Just tune in and listen to the Forgotten News podcast.
Welcome to Genuine Chit Chat, where we have honest conversations with interesting people. And I'm your host, Mike Burton. Hello there, my friends. We're back with Wayne once again, but this time, instead of talking about his incredibly interesting books about, God, I don't even describe them now. It's going to be a whole other almost podcast. It's just a really interesting look into the human condition in a way, and the dichotomy of the idea between good and evil. So if you haven't listened to the podcast before this one, check that one out for this. But this one is a completely different podcast altogether, recorded in the same sitting, but about a different subject. This one is going to be about paleontology, because as well as being an accomplished author and a general great guy, Wayne also has a degree in paleontology. So as I'm not smart enough to explain it in a very great way, I'm going to ask Wayne to tell people generally what paleontology is and why you sort of got into it and some of the sort of more intriguing things you've kind of learned, and we'll kind of go from there. So paleontology.
Okay. Paleontology is basically encompasses everything from the beginning of life up until human appearance. So it can be life's first existence 3.78 billion years ago up until, you know, modern humans arrived. So that's like 250, well, now 300,000 years ago. Thanks, Germany.
Finding out more, we'll go into that a little bit later on, but we'll come back to that. But yeah, sorry.
But yeah, paleontology basically encompasses all forms of life. So it can be from your three main realms. You can do paleobiology. You could do paleoclimatology. It literally has, it's just limitless. Mm. You can study isotopic data for weather systems that have changed over millennia. You can do you can go into fossil plants, you can go into fossil there's a section of it for vertebrate paleontology. It has real world applications, like in the oil industry, you know, how to tell how old the shales are that you're drilling will, you know, obviously equivalent for how much net worth your oil was worth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so paleontology, it's basically everything prehistoric, literally everything you can think of, you know, up from the last ice age, literally to the dawn of time. It encompasses it all, and everything that's fossil evidence, but it doesn't even have to be the actual animal itself. So you can have things called trace fossils, which are literally like worm burrows, casts, footprints, scour marks left behind from the animal. As long as it preludes to the fact that it was there at a time, it can be classed as any kind of fossil evidence. But there's also, you can go into sedimentology, so that's like the study of rock facies, and you get into sort of continental drift and more of those types of theories. So as a subject, it is very broad, and it normally coincides with other subjects like geology, geophysics, all those different kinds of things. So it's pretty much your, for a subject that was supposed to be quite offset, it's involved in a lot of other things.
Yeah, so obviously us, we won't be able to topic, we won't be able to get to everything. We won't be able to just start like, this is paleontology 101. We're going to teach you everything, because were you uni for 3 or 4 years? Or
3 years.
So obviously 3 years of learning all that information. And I imagine, like, in how much there is to know, your actual percentage knowledge of it is quite minuscule, because by such, it probably sounds like one of the most diverse, as you said, with all the little sort of subgenres within it, in a sense. There are so far that you can go into anything. I mean, I think you were telling me on the car ride here about there's the people you know who literally just study, as you said a minute ago, about the plants, just like literally just even almost sort of a type of plant you can spend your entire life, you know, 50 years with a master's degree going through just all the things that could be with this one plant. Mm. And that's like the amount of plant species that not only exist right now, but also have existed, not to mention all the, from plants to animals to everything. As you say, it's basically just everything from before a point. And it's like, well, that's everything, you know, and there's so much to know. And there's one of the examples is like how what we know about the past is only what we found or is what recorded. And obviously prehistoric, as it didn't really click with me until a few months ago. The term prehistoric is pre-history, pre-recorded history from humans. Mm-hmm. So it's like prehistory, prehistoric times is just, that's such a vast area. Mm-hmm. And one thing I think is, I may get these two mixed up, so you will have to correct me. Which came first, the Jurassic or the Cretaceous period?
The Jurassic.
So am I right in saying that the different, was it the T-Rex? It was something like the time period between the Cretaceous period and now is less time than between the Jurassic and the Cretaceous period.
That is correct, yes.
Yeah, so we are closer to the Cretaceous period dinosaurs, in a sense, than those dinosaurs were to the Jurassic period dinosaurs.
Yes, that is correct.
That's madness. That's just, you think about that, you go, wait, what? We are closer to, what? It's just like, those sort of little tidbits are what I love about this sort of thing. And so I think a good jumping off point would be what you said at the start, which is basically we believed it was about 200,000 years ago, which humans sort of, that's our current understanding of what humans are right now, which is a Homo sapien, that we thought the sort of the first ones kind of came from Africa about 200,000 years ago. But recently it was a tooth, I think you said, that was found in Germany. Mm-hmm. And it was it 250,000 years ago or 300,000 years ago?
300,000.
So you can take this off from here because that's all my knowledge. That's all I know about it.
Yeah, basically it was a upper molar found from a Homo sapien in the Rhine River in Germany. and it predates the oldest specimens of Homo sapiens in Africa by at least 50,000 years.
Mm.
So it's completely rewritten the fact that, you know, we may have been in Europe before we were in Africa, or maybe we were further globally distributed, or perhaps even Homo sapiens might have been around at that time, and we might have migrated from Europe into Africa and then back out to Europe. There's so many theories that now crops up.
You could even say we maybe even did start in Africa, but maybe we started in Africa like 350,000 years ago.
Precisely.
And we just haven't found the right fossils or anything like that, which is it's one of these things that one of the issues with some of the scientific world is that there's someone who could be, say, if we use dinosaurs as an example, dinosaurs being, we didn't used to think they all had feathers, and now it's coming to light that we think either all of them or most of them at least had feathers.
Yeah.
Well, if you had someone, before we found out that bit of information, if you had someone before that studying and teaching, their professor in a university, teaching everyone about dinosaurs for their entire career, 40, 50 years, whatever, about dinosaurs being in this specific way, and then this one piece of evidence or a few pieces of evidence have come out to completely disprove a element of what they've been teaching, people then often double down, and they're the first people to try and be like, no, that's not right, that's this, there's that, blah, blah, blah. And what ends up happening is you get people in the scientific community who are ironically holding on to their ideas more than the empirical fact, which is what they should have been doing the whole time. One of the most difficult things of being anyone who studies any of the sciences would be aware that relatively anything you know, if a new theory comes out or a new piece of evidence that could support it or anything along those lines, be aware that your own ideas of life and how things work can not be correct, and you have to be okay with that. Mm. And a lot of people aren't. And one of the things with today's society, not just in the scientific community, but with a lot of the things going with the left and the right, and people have such a hard time admitting when they're wrong. And it's taken me many years to really be able to grasp the thing of, it doesn't matter if you're wrong, because if you say something and it turns out you're wrong, the way you find out you're wrong 9 times out of 10 is by someone telling you the right answer.
Yeah.
So if you're wrong, that's fine, because then you know you're wrong, therefore you know it's right, therefore you're right again.
Yeah.
So there's no problem in having an open mind and accepting when you're wrong, because if you're surrounded by the kind of people who openly mock you for being incorrect about something, I mean, there's a bit of jokes and banter. You know, if you've got a mate and they think that a certain actor was in a film and they definitely weren't, you can take the mic, it's no biggie. But if it's like, if there's other things that people really grasp to and people really believed, and then it turns out they're incorrect, if you surround yourself with people who are generally quite positive and quite sort of feet on the ground, but the right amount of head in the clouds, of you just have it where a nice balance of, you're wrong, but that's fine. We thought the same way too, or we completely understand you thinking that way. However, this information shows this or that or the other. If you have a right network of people around you who can respect your ideas and respect everything, then there's no problem.
Yeah.
But you get the people who mock each other for being wrong, when all that being wrong is being ill-informed. And to be honest, obviously, with technology nowadays and the internet, you can argue that it is a degree of your own what else you put into it. If you want to, if you want to learn more about a certain thing, you do now have the tools to be able to just Google it, essentially. But you go back 20 years ago. I mean, even when we were in school together, you know, Facebook and Bebo and that sort of thing was kind of popping up.
Yeah.
But that we didn't have smartphones until, I think I had a smartphone in college was the first time. So that was when I was like 16, 17. And Facebook and stuff, I obviously use Facebook a fair amount and all the sort of social media and jazz. But like, you go back, 7 years ago, and that wasn't really a thing. I mean, Facebook was, I think it was started 2008, 2009-ish, around that sort of time. And obviously, depending on it first started at universities and all this sort of other things. So where it actually became public, it's, you know, a whole other thing, which I don't know enough about. But if you go back 20 years before, or even if you argue 30 years before that, where the internet kind of came about in the 90s, well, before that, finding out information, you either had to research it and hope the library had some information about it, or you just accepted what you were told.
Yeah.
And that's what I think a lot of the older generation, especially with the political system, are having issues with. When they're finding out, when they say immigration is costing this amount of money, or benefit fraud is causing this or that, this is information you're being told by the media. And whether or not certain people believe the media is corrupt, some people don't, I think a lot of the time it is due to the funding that gets from is, you know, from a lot of big businesses and things like that, which I'm not going to go into now because I want to talk about paleontology. But, you know, people, they double down these ideas, and they didn't have it at a time where now, you know, when your crazy aunt or grandparent says something, it's a bit stupid, and you go, that's not actually right. And they go, yes, it is. It's like, well, now you can pull out a device and prove them wrong. And it's like, it's not about proving someone wrong. It's about everyone being as well-informed as possible.
Mm.
But you go back 30 years ago, we didn't have the ability to be able to do that so easily. So it's more understandable why so many other people, especially in the scientific community, had such issue with when their ideas get flipped on their head. Mm. So I thought I'd ask you, what kind of, obviously, you did, the way you describe paleontology just then makes me think, why, who wouldn't want to go into it? But what kind of, what made you want to go into university for paleontology, like specifically? And then sort of what's some of the most interesting things you think you found about that? What are the sort of specialist areas you like, and what sort of kind of pulled you and kept you interested?
Okay. Well, to go into it, I've had a love for paleontology since I was 5, because it was literally like Jurassic Park, Prehistoric Park with, you know, with Nigel Marvin and those sort of TV series always got me hooked. I wanted to go into paleontology specifically for the dinosaurs.
I think a lot of people love dinosaurs when they were younger. Dinosaurs are so cool. I want to say, like, dinosaurs are amazing. I just want to carry it like that side thing. But yeah, sorry.
Yeah. And, you know, so you go into it and then you discover that it's like way, way bigger. You know, it covers so many different subjects. So I went into uni and I thought, right, okay, literally the whole of life, what part is going to interest us the most? And we actually did a project in our third year. We went down to Dorset and we actually found the articulated skull of an ichthyosaur from the Black Ben Formation. It's from the Upper Cinnamurian, which is about 194 million years old.
Jesus.
From the Middle Jurassic.
Even seeing something like that existing is just mind-blowing, just knowing that. And I just want to side thing is just with, when I'm sure that you got really into the Natural History Museum in London, things like that, where you go there, and there's a lot of dinosaur bones, that sort of thing, which a lot of them, as we've discussed before the podcast, are casts and things, because you can't actually always have a whole dinosaur skeleton, because 9 times out of 10, only certain parts of it are actually viable big enough to actually even be seen as a bone. A lot of the time it's fragments, or you've had say 1,000 T-Rex skeletons you found, and you found different parts of each one, and you kind of can make up, you know, what a general one is, so they make up the casts from other ones to make it. So people go into the Natural History Museum and stuff, not all of them are dinosaur bones, just to clarify, but seeing all those things, it made me really interested in this sort of stuff and science. And I just want a little thing and say, when I was in school, science really bored me. I thought the way they taught it, I did applied science, which is very boring, but the way they taught a lot of it was just, I wasn't even necessarily that keen about experiments necessarily. Mm. It's just some of the information they told you, some of the formatting and stuff was just not for me. And as soon as I got out of school, and once the internet became such a big thing, whenever I have these random questions, just 2 o'clock in the morning wondering what black holes actually are, even though you go into that and you go so far deep, it just, you're up there for hours. But just having that ability to look on the internet and just help reignite the sparks of my interest. Mm. Now that I'm an adult and I actually can understand it and I can go at my own pace to understand things, it's so much more intriguing to me. Mm. So with you and dinosaurs, hearing and about that sort of an early life, it's the good thing is with our growing up, we had like Jurassic Park, and as you said, you had was it Prehistoric Park, and obviously we had Walking with Dinosaurs, that sort of thing as well. So I just wanted to add that as a side thing. But sorry, continue with your
So
you got into it
with paleontology. It was a case of going into it because I thought, you know, everyone wants to be, I want to become a barrister, or I want to be a bank assistant, or all this kind of stuff. And it's like, that's not really interesting. You want to be able to wake up in the morning and think, I could find something that could rewrite history. Mm. I could change the world literally in finding something. And like I say, when we went down to Dorset and we found this articulated ichthyosaur skull, it took us 497 hours to prep this thing out. And we were only half done.
Wow. Is that with all the brushes and all the,
the care that you have to do with it? That's all the pneumatic abrasive pens and all that kind of stuff. We've recently just started work on the other side using a grout remover. Believe it or not. But it takes it off pretty well. And basically, it had skin still preserved.
Wow.
Bearing in mind, that's 197 million years old.
That's phenomenal, because that's the sort of thing that people are talking about with... there's a whole other... What was another podcast we could go on about this, but like with the cloning and stuff. Mm. It's like the idea that they've... I think, was it they basically had a chicken that they managed to make with a reptilian head or something, apparently, with, I think it was the BBC post about it recently. And it was basically, they had a tiny amount of DNA, I think from bone marrow or something along those lines, or a bit of skin. And they somehow managed to, when they had a chicken laying an egg, I don't know, because I'm not smart enough to understand this, but they basically managed to, layman's terms, splice it almost, and make it so that this being was born with a bit of DNA from these things. And like, when you need soft tissue, I think it is, to be able to replicate it in the same sort of way.
Yeah.
So, and also, you know, something being Something you got to think, like, something even being a few hundred years old and still having skin on it. Like, you dig up, if you went grave digging and stuff and you found humans, like, remains, a lot of them, I don't know how long it is specifically, but you become skeletons fairly regularly, quick, because of bacteria and other
3 weeks.
Insects. 3 weeks, there you go, so you know. So that's what I mean. So you got to think, like a couple of months, that's like quite a big deal to almost find skin, and then decades. But you're thinking, longer, that's such a long period of time, that is... It's, the thing is, when you go into millions, humans can't fathom a million, because you like to think you can,
yeah.
Because when you think of a million, you go, oh, the number a million, one, and then, you know, six zeros after it. It's like, yeah, but no one's really ever counted a million things, as in one, two, three. Obviously, you've got computers that can, or maybe you've got a catalogue of books, and you know in this library there's a million of them, but visualizing a million in actual physicality is so hard. And then when you add time to that, how many times have we had memories where you just go, oh yeah, that was a couple of months ago. Someone goes, mate, that was like a year and a half ago. And you're like, what? But the humans haven't even been around at all for, as we were just discussing, you know, say 300,000 years to our current knowledge. Mm-hmm. Well, that's like less than a third of 1 million. You know, that's 195 million years ago. I'm jealous of you. Obviously, you pursue this career path, so it's kind of like rewarding in that regard. Obviously, I've done nothing to do that career, so I don't deserve to find it like that. But that must have been next level finding something with a bit of skin on it. That's just phenomenal. Yeah. So when you found that, what sort of other stuff with that find? Have you learned anything specific from that? I know you haven't managed to get it out, but like.
Yeah, from the skin, there were like dark patches called melanosomes, which are used for fossil feathers as well. And if the right iridescence is portrayed and you put it on what they call backscatter cinematography and scanning electron microscopy, which we used on a sample of the skin, you could actually tell what colour the ichthyosaur was. Unfortunately, when we conducted the experiment on it, unfortunately the skin was too damaged to be able to tell, but from previous studies that have been done, ichthyosaurs are genuinely considered to be black. Okay. So walking with dinosaurs, you know, when you see the gray sort of dolphin type look, they were more thought as black. It would make more sense because they were deep sea hunters. They would have hunted squid and that kind of thing. Hmm. It definitely gives you the opportunity to stand with the highest ranking of paleos, and you could have only just started yesterday.
Mm.
That's the good thing about it. There's no hierarchy system. You could find something that could trump someone who's been in the business for 50 years.
Yeah.
That's the thing that interests me in paleontology and drew me to it.
Because opening the door sort of thing.
Yeah, of course. And all the theories that they came up with, for one, evolution, the one thing about evolution that people contest is the lack of evidence. They say, oh yeah, but you've got missing links between like dinosaurs and birds. Mm. All right, you've got so many, the evolution of horses, you have them going from something that was the size of a cat to today. You have them losing limbs. Mm. You don't think of a horse as having five toes. It did at one point.
Mm.
You have all these different stages and you have the fossils there because in a short space of time, the evolution of the horse occurred. It was like something like 3.5 million years. It was nothing. Blink of an eye in the mirror. Scheme of time.
Yeah.
But when you have something like between dinosaur groups, something that's quite rare to find, I mean, loads of dinosaurs have been found, but in themselves, they're quite rare finds, especially fully articulated, like you said earlier.
Mm.
And the point is, being able to contribute and find a fossil that slots into one of those gaps, just it does your self-credit because you think to yourself, you know, Charles Darwin, all those years ago, he must have thought to himself, do you know what? This is just a stupid theory. I have no way of proving this. Mm. You know, like any kind of physicist or anyone in the sciences that comes up with a theory and thinks, there's no way I can test this, no way I can prove it. And then future generations go and prove it for him. It's almost like, you know...
Legacy.
Yeah,
precisely. If the Darwin is one of, for me, one of the most, obviously a lot of people held this view, one of the most important people who've ever lived, because... It does what he found and what he realized, just the stepping stone and the general idea has opened the door to such an en masse of findings. And he was obviously critiqued by primarily who was in power at the time, which is obviously a lot of religion was in power at the time, who from history, a lot, you know, the Dark Ages, all these sorts of other things, and with Galileo as well, with his idea of, I think he was the one who discovered that we were orbiting the sun and things. Yeah. And it's like, all these brilliant minds due to people who, not necessarily just blaming religion, but people holding on to these beliefs that they refuse to let go of, that they refuse to change. And science nowadays, especially with so many more people into it and so much more evidence and better technology, I mean, there's like with ultrasound and things, there have been planes and things that have flown over South America and found like ruins that are under the surface by quite a far, well, and they are miles in size, and we, because we just hadn't dug in the right spot, we hadn't found them.
Yeah.
And as technology is going to get better and better, we're going to be able to use ultrasound to such a fine, specific degree. Mm. Be able to fly over a cliff, do a bit of ultrasound, and you go, well, there's something, you know. Our normal excavations only go, say, I don't know how far down they go, but let's say 10 meters if we dig that deep. But they go, oh, well, this is actually 50 meters down. We would never dig that deep in a cliffside just for no reason, this one specific spot. So we're getting the tech to be able to do that. And with people like yourself and all the other people who loved dinosaurs when they were younger and this sort of thing, people have this passion and really want to make a difference, or people who just want to fuel their own knowledge of these things will help curb the future generations, you know. Mm. Your findings or the findings of your team, even if it's one small thing to you or one small thing that it may seem to the whole community, that is adding another page in the book of someone's going to pick up one day and read through it all as one big thing and be like, this is amazing, this is what I love. Yeah. And then, although your finding may not change the world like Darwin did, mm, it adds, you know, you can't have a glass of water without drops. You know, it's one glass of water, but everything in there can be taken away drop by drop. Mm. And that's what science is. It's adding, even if it's one drop at a time, just adding to that big picture that slowly, I've described this before, is, and you can use this example in almost any walk of life, is with science, I look at it as where we are now, because the modern technology, we've only had, you know, electricity working properly for about 150 years or so. And even now we've got TVs and stuff. In the last 30 years has been accelerating due to the technological revolution. Obviously the industrial revolution as well helped that as well. And like all these things adding to it. And it's like our current understanding of the universe, both with the ideas of spirituality as well as core science and things, and consciousness and the universe and potential other realities, as well as evolution and the animals and the beings that could have walked the earth before our modern day humans. You look at that, and the way it is we're basically an infant looking through a keyhole into an atrium, and we think, or certain people believe, that they know all the answers because they think that what they've seen through the keyhole is the whole picture.
Yeah.
When in reality, and I say this when you're a child, whereas you become an adult, when you're an adult, when you're a child, basically, you're looking through the keyhole and you can only just see things. And when you're a teenager, you look through the keyhole and then you're like, I've seen that lampshade, I know exactly what's in the room. Mm. When you're an adult, the door gets opened. You don't necessarily even get let in the room. But you then stand there and you realise you knew nothing about what was in that room. You thought that thing was a lamp. To be honest, it was a picture, like a painting. And in that painting was a lamp.
Yeah.
And it was like, that's not even relevant to anything else that's in this whole room. And that's kind of what science is.
Mm.
And science is this, where at the start with Galileo and with Darwin and that sort of thing, it was almost like a pinprick in a door. And now what we thought was it was one door. And then what it actually is you keep taking step back, it's a cliff. And to even open that cliff up, we can see like a hole the size of probably like a 50p coin of how much we actually know about it, especially with evolution. And like, as the days go by, it's someone slowly opening that tiny little hole each day, maybe even each year, just slowly opening it on this thing opening that's the size of a cliff.
Mm.
And even when we actually manage to open up that thing to that size and how many years it's going to take, that's not even going into this hypothetical doorway, going down to this hypothetical like cliff with this massive cave system of information. It's like, it's so overwhelming, but it's so gratifying in a lot of ways. And one of the things that, like, as I've said myself, I'm an atheist and you're a Christian, and it's very commendable of you being so open-minded with you believing in a deity, which I think is completely fine, and as I say, it's completely fine to believe in that, but still going with science and evidence and evolution, and it's very commendable, you know, having your own mind and thinking, this is what I believe in this, but I also believe that, and not letting anyone else tell you have to believe this or that.
Mm.
It's finding your own way, because I don't think anyone's right. I think everyone has little pieces of what could potentially be right.
Yeah.
And one of the things I say with, we've discussed purpose a little bit, is in the previous podcast, we spoke about it a little bit, and I just find that regardless of how you think world came to be, I think you make your own purpose.
Mm.
But I think the idea of whether you think that a God created you or if you don't, the fact that you're here is just such unbelievable odds to one.
Mm.
And like any step you take in any direction is Everyone is an individual. Humans are very many similarities between us all in so many different ways. And even if you're pursuing a similar career path to someone and you have similar music tastes or all these sort of similarities, everyone is a complete individual. And everyone's got their own individual path. And I wouldn't say necessarily that even though Darwin was a massive step forward, and I think there are certain outliers, I think nowadays it's more, there are the odd people who maybe make a bigger impact in a public way, like Steve Jobs, as I said in the previous podcast, I think, or maybe it's the start of this one, who knows? And even if you specifically aren't known to be the Steve Jobs, aren't known to be this, there are hundreds of paleontologists who made these discoveries, who maybe aren't that well known, who still made such a big effect and such a big ripple effect on, even if you talk to me and I talk to, if we ignore the aspect of a podcast, I talk to one person I know, or I have a kid one day and I talk to them about it, and just a bit of information you gave me, I tell them, and that sparks something in them. Mm. And even if it's, they make the next Darwin idea or they make the next one of this, it's all of us as a community coming together and learning together. And every step we take should be all of us taking a unified step together.
Precisely.
And I just think what you're doing is just fantastic. And this learning about it is just, even though I keep interrupting you, learning about this was just fantastic. And so I'd like you to continue with your story with my gigantic tangent.
Yeah. Basically, the interest can go into loads of different things. I mean, just through going through the course of paleontology, I believe on the way back from uni, actually, I bumped into Reese on the train, and he was like, "Oh, hey, you know, what have you been up to?" And I was like, "I was literally just staring at pollen grains." He was like, "Pollen grains? Wow, yeah, that sounds amazing." And I was like, "Yeah, it is quite, because they're 510 million years old."
Oh, Jesus Christ!
From like some of the first land plants ever. They're called Rhynia,
right?
And they're about a centimeter tall, and you think, it's thanks to billions of these that we actually had an atmosphere.
Yeah.
You know,
mate, it's crazy.
And the awesome things were that just as we thought that plants literally paved the way for life, there was even life at that point as well. Because in one of the pollen grains from one of this Rhynia, there was a Trigonotarbid.
Oh, wow.
Actually,
okay.
Inside it, which is like this 10-legged arachnid sort of relative.
Mm.
That looks sort of like a sea bear.
If ever you've seen one of them. Josh's favourite animal, I think, is a sea bear. Do you know what the actual term for them is? Because I can never remember.
Not off the top of my head.
That's fine. I'll look it up in a minute. But yeah, continue, sorry.
But, yeah, so one of them being found, you know, taking refuge in this pollen grain. It's absolutely amazing, you know. And it came out of a rock formation called the Rhynie Chert, which is basically like these huge geysers, which would...
Mm-hmm.
Basically spew a load of, you know, hard sort of chalkish water, and that chalk then fossilized these plants and preserved them for 510 million years. So
madness.
You can go from studying that to studying something, like I say, as large as, you know, the largest land animal ever to live, like a titanosaur, or, you know, this leg is literally 10 feet tall, and that's just its femur. And
yeah,
you think the colossal size of that animal. You think about the amount of vegetation, and it'd
have to consume as well.
Yeah.
It would have to, like, you think of, like, people think of like a bear, for example. They have to eat so many pounds and pounds and pounds of things. But would you say it was a water bear? I think that's the animal, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's called a tardigrade. If anyone wants to look up a tardigrade, as tardigrades, they're basically water dwelling eight-legged segmented micro animals, and they're basically, they can survive through anything. They think they can survive in space and stuff, actually.
They're known as extremophiles.
Yeah, they're like, they can survive basically any conditions. So do you say you found something that was that, or something similar to that?
Something similar to that. It's like a close relative.
Yeah, so even that's just like these creatures that we couldn't even fathom existing of, that can survive some ridiculous conditions, and a lot of them being microscopic and this sort of thing as well. It's like, well, they're in theory, there could be some around here, but you can't see them because not everything you're looking at right now is looked at through a microscopic lens. Our human sight isn't that good.
Exactly.
So you finding that in a, or you looking at something that's found that within it, is just opening the door once again to just, you can even have it where you're just studying plants, and then you could in theory just find this microscopic being that you've never heard or seen before. So it's never like a downplay the importance of the quote unquote small roles of, whether it's science, whether it's life, whether it's the bin men, whether it's anyone in life, every part of society, every part of science, they must come together in sort of an equal playing field, in a sense. So you found you found these you were speaking then about the chalk. I'm trying to learn all this information, is making my brain hurt. These plants that have been fossilized due to the chalk spray. I don't know how to describe
it. Yeah, the geyser. Sort
the geyser. That was it. Yeah. So you found them as well, and continue on with some more things.
Yeah. So you can go into sort of like the geological history just of the British Isles. You wouldn't believe it, but the British Isles was made up of 16 different islands.
Really? Wow. Yeah.
And basically, over a period of about 50 million years, Scotland and several parts of England, the Isle of Wight was once connected, obviously, but with rising sea levels and ice ages. And it's one of the reasons why we still experience earthquakes.
Yeah.
You know, you get them down in... down in Land's End, you know, it's only like 3 or 4. It's nothing big. But the reason is that faults still exist from 50 million years ago because of those faults that separated Ireland from Britain. Basically, if you can imagine, the whole British Isles was one island at one point, just the same as the world. You know, everybody thinks, oh, we've only ever had one supercontinent. We've actually had 4.
Really?
Yeah. The amount of times that countries have come together and then split in loads of different...
Is that due to volcanoes segments? As well as earthquakes and all these sorts of gargantuan sort of, not even anomalies, just things that happen in life? You think, a lot of people don't realize with earthquakes, like a small earthquake or medium-sized earthquake, they can have repercussions. But when you get these absolutely colossal ones or super volcanoes, they have super volcanoes on certain planets that can just turn the entire planet into just volcanic ash, because they're so colossal that they have such a huge amount of magma and lava within them that it just can cover a whole thing. So people underestimate some of the craziness of the almost natural disasters, in air quotes, because of, like, with people, like, there's extinction events as well that people don't think about, where people go, oh yeah, was that one with the dinosaurs with the meteor? So, well, that was one that we know of. There could have been hundreds, if not thousands, that we know of. I think we know of a few, don't we?
There's 8 major ones
that we know of. Yeah. So why don't we go into them then a little bit, your knowledge of them.
So what you have, you have 3 just in the Devonian period. That's basically where we start seeing the rise of bony fish.
Your
armor-plated fish like Dunkelosteus, Lepidectes, just to name a few. And basically, that was basically a mass extinction. It was nothing major. You sort of had basically a global anoxia event, if you can believe as such, where all the oceans became anoxic. Right. No oxygen whatsoever. Basically, it was a biological turnover.
Yeah.
So all the decaying organisms that had settled at the bottom of the ocean had basically risen to the top, and the microorganisms that were then using it to make energy from, the gas that they produced, the sulfur dioxide that they were producing, was sufficient enough that it caused a 35% decrease in all life in the oceans.
Okay.
You then go into one at the end of the Permian.
Yep.
Which was an absolutely devastating mass extinction that wiped out 95% of all life on Earth.
Jesus.
There are so many different theories of what it was, even up to the point of a gamma ray burst, basically.
Is that from the solar flare? Yeah. Gamma radiation being, obviously something that can kill relatively everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically, they theorize that that's why trilobites are black, because literally they were just cooked.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And they've also found an iridium spike round about the Permo-Triassic border as well. So, you know, there's been theories of a supermassive volcano erupting, which brought about an ice age, a miniature ice age, to a meteorite impact, to, again, another global anoxia event. You know, we're aware of 6 times that the ocean actually became fully anoxic. And you just think the size of the ocean... You think, how is that even possible with ocean circulation and all that kind of stuff? How is it even? But then you move into the Carboniferous. There was one that occurred at the end of the Carboniferous. The idea was that because of all the free oxygen that was in the atmosphere, obviously there was a depletion in greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. This is one of the reverse effects of if you get too aware of greenhouse gases. They are good for the planet because they maintain a certain amount of heat. Not to the point as is today. The only difference being is we're burning millions of years worth of fuel that should be released over millions of years in a few hundred years. Yep. That's why we're experiencing problems. But the idea is that it caused such a cool sort of temperature that it dramatically changed climate. That's why the Triassic is associated with deserts. Mm. Like, everywhere you look, everything is desertified simply because it dried out. You know, and you think, well, if it cooled the temperature down, how the hell did it dry everything out? Well, think about it. If you're cooling stuff down, you're making more ice, there's less water into the environments, mm-hmm. less water able to filtrate into them, so you have less fertile soil, bang, you've got deserts everywhere.
Mm.
Then you have one in the early Jurassic, which again was brought on by either a meteorite impact or just climate change in general. Then you have one at the end of the Jurassic, which was brought on by, again, anoxic events. And the interesting part was bringing it back onto the ichthyosaur that we found. She was smack dab in the middle of that mass extinction event, so it could have been what killed her.
Oh, wow.
That's why when you go to areas like Dorset and you look into the Black Fen, that's why it's called the Black Fen, because it has so much organic matter in it, because literally everything was just wiped out. Mm. So it all just settled, and that's why it's a black shale. When you sort of take it off the cliff, it's almost oily.
Okay.
Because it's got so much organic matter preserved in it.
Mm.
And then obviously you have... They say it's the KT event. It's more the KPG, because you've got the Cretaceous-Paleogene border. Everyone says it's 65 million years ago. You can agree with that. That's fine. It's actually 65.3, if you want to get technical about it. The idea is there are loads of different theories. There are paleontologists that I know down at Portsmouth University that will literally argue until they're blue in the face to say it was not a meteorite. You can believe it was. The one thing about being a paleontologist is you cannot say with 100% certainty this caused a mass extinction. Mm. It was a series of events that were probably triggered by every single one of them. Mm. They all collaborated together to cause this mass extinction.
Mm.
It's not a nuke. You can't plan when it's going to go off. You can't plan how many things it's going to kill.
Well, sometimes it can be like huge amounts of almost, I don't necessarily believe in luck, but you can almost say something really unlucky. Like, you know, you can have a star explode galaxies away. Mm-hmm. It can cause some of the planets to burst or explode or whatever. A shard of rock could fly off that, and by somewhere being affected by numerous black holes and other gravitational pulls and things, it just happens to hit Earth. Mm-hmm. And it happens to hit, say, the polar ice caps. That will then release a flood, and then that's a theory that some people have, where a meteorite hit the hit some of the polar ice caps, that cause a mass flood event. Well, that things like that, where it's one event triggers another one, you can almost have an infinite ripple effect of, yeah, that caused that flood, which caused this cliff over here to fall down, which caused this happened, and then that caused this to happen, and all these cliff sides then fell, but that tremor caused the tectonic plates to shift a bit more, which caused another earthquake. And you could say this one thing that happened caused five or six other things to happen, which then would have caused the mass extinction event. And there's also some arguments for also people say humans, we're so thinking we're going to live forever. All it would take is one decently sized meteor to, like, Jupiter's been protecting us from quite a few of them. But it's like, it would take one biggish meteor to hit planet Earth, and it would cause such a massive, I'd say, ripple almost. It would just destroy all life on it like that. But also what people don't think about with mass extinction events, not only people think a lot of them are going to be man-made, like, you know, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un doing dick measuring contests and nuking each other, which is a possibility. There's also super diseases, you know, because of the antibiotics and stuff that we're overusing, we're becoming, the diseases like the super flu and things like that are becoming they're becoming less susceptible to all the medicine we have for them, so therefore we can't do anything about them. And then if there's just one global pandemic, that if it got the right amount of airborne sort of infectiousness, I'm not very good with the terminology, mixed with how lethal it is, it could wipe relatively every human out. It could wipe out any, like, avian flu was a thing, as was swine flu, all these sorts of other things that people don't really think about, is that there are so many things that could wipe out life on Earth. Whether there's the I think Yellowstone's got an active volcano, hasn't it? And I think, is it Lanzarote, I think it is, or Gran Canaria, one of the two, they've got an active volcano there. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to erupt, but that doesn't mean it won't. It could take an undersea earthquake with tectonic plates under their movement, and that could cause, just because we're obviously, volcanoes have to go down to the core to get all the magma and stuff. If there was some sort of earthquake, or even if there's a tsunami that was wrong, that then hit some of the rock out the way, or something, all these possibilities that can just make one thing happen, chain of events.
Exactly.
And it's crazy to think about, and with paleontology, what it can show you is the sheer mass possibility of not only what was and what could have been, but also what caused what to happen, as you say, with the either 150 or 510 million year old the pollen things. You say how old they were, and like how these plants can just affect everything around them, and just these things that may seem like tiny discoveries can, even if there's a tiny discovery now, you could go, you know, years and years down the future, and then this discovery you've made now could have actually been the thing that made this super discovery or whatever. So the more you talk about paleontology, the more excited I am about it. It just sounds so amazing, and it's so interesting to be able to have someone to talk about it with. It's fantastic. So we've spoken about some of the mass extinction events and whatnot, and so what is there a specific field in paleontology that really calls out to you, like either a time period or a certain type of plant or animal, anything that really kind of hooked you?
It's the Jurassic period, definitely, because obviously that's where the ichthyosaur comes from. And mostly that's where dinosaurs are sort of coming into their heyday, you know, but also what they're sharing the planet with. You know, we're seeing the development of flight for the first time, and not just gliding but powered flight, but also going back into the Carboniferous, and even the early Eocene. I'm fascinated with fossil insects, anything to do with fossil insects, whether it's in amber, whether it's in sandstone preservation, whatever it is. It just absolutely fascinates me. You know, the fact that back in the Carboniferous, there were tarantulas that if they were around today, they'd be hunting cats.
Yeah.
You know, we had dragonflies like Meganeura that had a meter long wingspan.
I've heard about these super insects and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. You had Arthropleura, which was a 6-foot long centipede.
Yeah.
You know, they were massive, absolutely massive animals. Because of the oxygen levels and the fact that they didn't have any natural predators, it enabled them to get so large. But even going forward, you know, we went to Germany as part of our paleontology course. We went to a place called Mesel in Germany, and it was this fossil lake. Mm-hmm. And inside were preserved about 38 million year old insects, and they still had color on their elytra, you know, their wing cases.
Oh, wow.
And you were able to see like such detail in these fossil insects, and the fossil preservation was so good that they're able to take it to, you know, the Hadron Collider.
Yes.
In the CERN.
Switzerland.
They have another facility in there that allows you to blast electrons at a fossil, and it three-dimensionally maps it.
Oh, okay, basically. Awesome.
And they were able to do that with a lot of these insects, and they've actually mapped the internal structure
really?
Of a lot of these insects.
So the way their insides work and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So literal, almost, it's almost like having one there. It was like,
exactly.
It's like a digital, what's the word when you open things up and stuff? Like you look inside.
Yeah, like a digital vivisection.
That's the word. I just couldn't think of it. Yeah, that's phenomenal technology these days, and how far, much further it's going to go.
Mm.
But so some of those gigantic insects, like I'm not the biggest fan of this film, but King Kong would be an example of in the movie King Kong, not the new one, which is actually quite good, the old one with Jack Black in it, that's not that great. They go into that pit, which is probably the only good part of the whole film, where they've got all these giant bugs, and I imagine a lot of people look at them like, "That's a giant bug. What's that all about?" And it's like, because this Earth, we like to think of it, the way we look at it now is the way it's always been, which is not the case. Because not only with the oxygen levels, with all the different continents and stuff, with all the different, the amount of moisture in the air, every sort of tiny little, that's what climate change is, why it's such a big thing, what people really understand. They go, oh, 1 or 2 degrees, what difference does that make? So that's a global average, but it's like, even a few degrees can be the difference between certain insects thriving or dying. Like, I think the gender of so a lot of semi-aquatic animals, I think turtles have this, where the temperature where they lay their eggs actually determine the gender of the
child.
Yeah, it's not actually to do with like average mammals. Most mammals have this, where it's basically just the male or the female, one of the two. It has the, I think humans, it's the male, basically the gender is determined by the sperm. And that obviously makes whatever, it's almost like a flip of a coin in a sense. But obviously, if you go back to genealogy, you go back to, if you've got a family like my family, primarily a male, so they've given, you know, you think that the likelihood is it's probably going to be males. But with, when you go to climate change and you go into the repercussions of that, as well as, you know, destroying habitats, you could make it so that if, I can't remember which way around it is, I'm not sure if you know with turtles, if it's too hot, it makes females, or too cold, it makes males, or whatever it is. Well, if, for example, it's too hot and they only make females, well, they can't if the species become extinct. And people don't realise that's only a couple of degrees. Whereas when you get these either mass events or mass extinction events, where just all it takes is one volcano to shoot enough ash into the sky to block out the sun to reduce the global temperature by X amount, or have not enough of this vitamin in there, either it makes certain animals or plants adapt and evolve in different ways they wouldn't have normally gone down, or it can just wipe them out completely. And then when you wipe them out completely, it's almost like a vacuum, because people say, like, you know, if we killed, say, all the bugs, obviously this bugs are probably one of the most important things on the whole planet, but if we just say we killed all of the natural food of one bird, well, that's not just affecting the bird and the insect that you'd be killing anyway. It's the bird, all the predators of the bird, all the pollination that happens because of the birds, all of the everything that these type of birds do, the sort of the ripple effect of everything. And that's what I keep saying is ripple effect, because people need to understand that not only in their own lives, but in the whole world, is that every action has, in a sense, that you know, an equal to negative sort of reaction. You can think of it in the physicist sort of way, but even think of it as just, if something happens, it's going to affect something else.
Yeah.
Very, very simply. So with all these sorts of learning about paleontology, you can learn almost what not to do, in a sense. And that's why I imagine you're quite passionate about climate change, in the sense that I am, and I don't even know that much about it, to be honest. But it's just like all these things where people are either saying, oh, it's not a big deal, or it's not happening like this, not like that. It's like, you don't understand the repercussions of if it is happening, which I'm pretty fucking certain it is, and especially pretty certain it is because of us, it's being accelerated. It's going to make things evolve in different ways. It's going to make potential things die in other ways. It's going to change the landscape of Earth, most likely for the worse. But it's going to change it some way or another. And when it changes it, and when certain animals change, if it makes it so that a certain animal is no longer as much of a hunter, then it means that its prey may become overrun, and then that could end up killing that species by starvation or disease. Or it could end up making that one thrive, and then it could end up making other animals that didn't normally eat them eat them, and then it could make that animal population thrive because there's so much more of a food source. And it's just, everywhere you look at it, it's just, there's so many other things that can affect other stuff, and it's just, yeah, what you've been saying is just fantastic.
A great representation of that, you know, just as classic as the film is A Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah.
It perfectly encapsulates just how fragile the balance is. You know, just adding one part per meter squared of fresh water can be enough to tip the balance to actually have that occur. You know, people just don't realize that. But you want facts. We are wiping out 13 species of animal a day.
Yeah.
You know, and for all the species that have yet to be discovered, most of them we won't discover, because we will have wiped them out before we've even had a chance to stumble upon them.
And a lot of people don't realise with a lot of the sciences, is one of the arguments from, not to paint the same brush with everyone religious, obviously, but there are a lot of religious organizations and things that seem to act like, when you try and explain evolution to them, they go, scientists act like they have all the answers. It's like, no, we don't. I'm not a scientist, so I haven't got, you are, but it's like, we don't know anything, as I said earlier on. Like, we think what we know is true, but we're not certain. But with species, like, I think it's like with insects, we've only actually discovered such a small, like, percentage of what actual insects there are, because it's not quite like this, but it's almost like every time you have a group of scientists or paleontologists or anything go into the Amazon rainforest for a couple of months, they almost always discover new insects and stuff. You have to think about how vast their certain places are of that we haven't seen, like even the ocean. Like we know less about our own ocean than we do about, I think, the moon. It's like, how can we think that? It's like, well, because there's so many parts of the ocean we haven't discovered, and so much of what life came from was the ocean. Like, I think the most common theory is basically all life originated, started in the ocean, and then it kind of went from there. And then eventually creatures learned to kind of go out of the water, either momentarily or for certain things, and then eventually became land dwellers and da-da-da. So it's just like, we know so little, which is what makes this so interesting, of you can study this for your entire life. And even if you only study it broadly, the amount of insects that get discovered daily, the amount of species that we discover of certain, like even just slight variations of creatures we already know exist, not just insects, but also other beings, you know, another type of marmoset, or another type of this, or another type of that. Just even knowing, it's just this knowledge. And what is so interesting to me is I love learning knowledge and new stuff. And the animal kingdom, it's so majestic. Some of the coolest animals humans are pretty cool. Like, we've done some pretty cool shit, let's be fair, you know. We made the Terminator movies. They're fucking cool. But, you know, we made Shawshank Redemption. That's a great movie too. But, like, you go down of all the great things we've done and all the horrible things you've done, but then you go to, like, all these beings that they don't care or have any interest in what humans have done, whether or not they even have the basis of consciousness in the same way, we're not fully sure. But some of the insect world is so intriguing. Like, one of the main ones I bring up is the praying mantis, you know, the female mates of the male, they cut off their head. That's part of it. You have other ones like you have a type of wasp that injects its prey with its eggs, and then I think it's paralyzed, isn't it, from the, and it can't move. And then its larva, as in the wasp injects something, often spiders, I think, quite regularly. Yeah. I think they're called something.
That's tarantula hawk wasp.
There we go. See, I've got little bits of information. I haven't got the whole picture. And they sting the tarantulas. They become paralyzed, but they're still alive, so that they plant their larva within them, and then their larva eat them from, let's see, the inside out. And it's like, first of all, that's obviously horrendously fucked up and horrendous. But that is so unbelievably cool that evolution basically went that way and made just that one bug, or one insect rather, do that. Mm-hmm. And then you just think of all the other crazy ways of like, there's bees when they have, like, hornets invade their hives and stuff. They do that thing where they all latch onto them and they all vibrate and move really quick.
Yeah,
and they create such heat that it cooks them. And it's like, bees are so awesome, making honey and all the craziness, and bees are awesome animals anyway, and they literally all just pile on something and create enough heat energy to cook them. It's like, that's so amazing, that's so cool. You watch it, it's freaky as hell, because watching all the bees swarm over something is awful to think about happening to you. But, like, you have ants that are the hive mind, you have those, I think I mentioned it in a podcast a couple of times before, where you get the you get that kind of, I think it's a fungus that goes into the, it makes a sapling into the ant's mind, and then it makes them crawl up really high.
Cordyceps.
There you go. And it makes them, you know, it takes over their essential function of their, mm-hmm. their motor function stuff. So it just makes the ant just crawl up as high as it will go to the closest thing of sunlight and just stay there, and it dies. And the plant grows out mm-hmm. their head. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we could sit here for hours and hours and hours and just talk about all the cool shit that even just the insect kingdom and even mm-hmm. fungus and stuff can do. So we're getting closer to the hour mark now, which I think I could talk to you about this for constantly. So maybe we'll have to visit it back and have a bit more of a structure, see what we can figure out. But as a little wrap up, do you have a favourite animal? I know it's probably, knowing so many is quite difficult. How about a favourite animal, if you can think of this, that's potentially alive today, animal, insect, and maybe one of the favourites that's now extinct? And we can kind of finish it off as that sort of thing, and you can tell me the reasons why.
My favourite animal still extant, so alive today, is the snowy owl, just because it's freaking awesome.
I love owls. Snowy owls are one of my favourite as well,
interested
actually.
In owls. They've always represented wisdom, and in Swedish folklore, they were always the passage of soul to the afterlife, which I always thought was awesome as well.
Yeah.
But snowy owls, they just look so graceful. Mm. Like, everything about them is just amazing. You look them at winterscapes and that kind of thing, they're pretty cool. As far as extinct, I absolutely love glyptodons. They're like the cousin of the armadillo, but they were the size of a car.
Oh, wow.
Basically, they were part of the megafauna that existed in South America during the Paleogene, which was literally just after the Cretaceous. You know, so you had this mass extinction of a meteorite. And because all those niches were then removed, you had this armadillo growing to that sort of size. But the awesome thing was it had a club on the end of its tail, which weighed half a ton.
Oh, wow.
It was freaking awesome. And they find them fossilized in sort of river deposits, but the shell is upside down, because obviously there's so much hollow space inside them that when they drowned, they literally just sailed. So you just imagine these dead glyptodons just piling up against each other, trying to get out to the ocean type thing. So you're like, oh, man, that's awesome.
Oh, those animals, that's fantastic. I mean, one of the things you say about owls, I mean, whenever I try to think of my favourite animal, I often can't fully figure out. I have to write it down and work it out, because I said with Josh, one of our Science But Simple episodes, we're probably going to do like our favourite animals and stuff. So maybe I'll get you in on that. And one of the things is with owls, as you say, one of the cool things I found out about owls is they're not actually, ironically, they're not necessarily that smart in terms of the bird world, because they actually have quite small brains comparatively. Because you think, if you see the owl's head and you think, oh, they've got quite a big brain, because that's generally speaking how things work with the animal kingdom. The bigger your head is, the bigger your brain is. But it's because their eyes are so huge in their head, because they're so good. Their eyes are so amazing, because obviously they can see in the dark and they can see so far, and you have to see a tiny scutter of a rodent movement, seeing a blade of grass move in a different way to the way all the wind's making it move, and all these sort of amazing things that they have, and they can't look with their eyes in a different way. That's why they can turn their head almost 360, because they have to be able to move their head because they can't actually move their eyes in their sockets. And it's like, we'd have an hour long chat about owls and it would be awesome. It's just like, there's so many cool things in the animal world and stuff. So, you know, this has been incredibly enlightening. I'm going to have to listen back to this to try and pick up all the information, because there's so much to take in. But it's been fantastic having you on and chatting about this, and I'll definitely have to inquire about you coming on in the future and teaching us more about animals with Josh's degree in marine biology mixed with your degree in paleontology. That's just, I'm going to have to accumulate all these really smart people that know lots about animals, and I could just sit in the middle and know barely anything. Like, I like pandas. I quite like them, even though they're very stupid animals who really should be extinct by now, but we keep letting them not be extinct. And it's like, I don't want pandas to be extinct because they're great, but they don't even really want to mate ever. And they're so lazy and they're so difficult to make mate, they're going to be gone at some point. But yeah, absolutely stellar having you on. As I said at the start, we've done two podcasts, one about the two books you've written and the series that you're, the book series that you're making, and the intricate details of the sort of the dichotomy between good and evil in the male and the human psyche, as well as just the human condition, and in sort of a spiritual sense, as well as just morality and all these sorts of interesting things that we spoke about in the first podcast. So I'd say to anyone, go out, check out those books and check out the podcast, and then this one all about paleontology. So once again, thank you very much for coming on, Wayne. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And that's the end of another episode. Thanks as always for tuning in, guys. As I said at the start, I've got another podcast with Wayne, which was the one released last week. That one is about kind of like the opposite side of the spectrum, in a sense. It's actually about the human condition, people, good versus evil. We talk about Wayne's two books that he's written. They're fiction books set in the 19th century, following a sort of Jekyll and Hyde sort of story. I don't want to give too much away because we speak about it quite a lot on the podcast. And we also talk about inspiration and how Wayne wants to spread this message of hope, which I found was just amazing. So I really highly recommend you guys check that out. And the other ones I mentioned at the start of the podcast were Science But Simple. I've got two episodes of those released at the moment. The first one being How Light Bulbs Work. It's a real easy to understand way of just describing energy in quite a simple way. And then the second one is about gravity, the tides and the moon. They're both about an hour long, a little bit under, I think. And I discuss science things with basically my buddy Josh, who's got a degree in marine biology. So he knows way more about science and all that sort of stuff than I do, as you could have probably heard from this episode with Wayne. Wayne knows infinitely more about it, but that's good, because both Wayne and Josh do have degrees in science, so you'd hope for them to know more than just I do. And a new one me and Josh will be releasing, I believe it's actually going to be next week, is basically debunking misconceptions. We speak about GMO, which is genetically modified organisms. You know, when people worry about food and stuff like that, that's GMO. We speak about cancer and some of the sort of misconceptions with that, as well as big pharma and the whole sort of drug industry, of sort of how like medicine's actually made, rather than there's a lot of people who think that there's a cure for cancer out there and it's just the big pharma companies are hiding it from us, and which obviously we can't prove isn't happening. But we talk in depth about that sort of thing and why we believe it couldn't be, and that how they make medicine, and sort of it's just debunking really scientific things. There's three major parts of it, so that'll be as the three major things we debunk in the episode, and we talk about that next week. And then the coming weeks, over the next 2 months, I'm recording, I think I've got 7 or 8 podcasts listed for recording. I'm hoping they'll each be 1 to 2 hour ones, so I may be able to split quite a few of them. So I should have a lot of podcasts sorted out for this coming year. Some of them are, I'm really excited for some of them. Some of the guests I've got are really cool. So, you know, as always, guys, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, any of the podcast apps, including Stitcher or Podbean or anything like that. It really goes a long way to help. Leaving reviews as well is a fantastic way to let me know sort of how I'm doing, be it on iTunes, or you can email us at genuinechitchat@outlook.com. The links and that sort of stuff will be in the description of the episode, and on all the social media you can normally find a way. You can message me on any of the social media, anything like that at all. I welcome any and all feedback, really. So yeah, as always, guys, thanks for tuning in, and I'll talk to you next week.